I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today is with actor Pierre Doulet. We'll join the many people who still bug him with the question, what did 2001 Space Odyssey mean? But first, Ingrid Betancourt, former Colombian presidential candidate and the most high-profile hostage released in yesterday's rescue, embraced her two now teenage children for the first time in 6 years today. She gave a long press conference and said through an interpreter that the first thing to do now is call Presidents Chavez and Correa of neighboring Venezuela and Ecuador,
so that they will help us reestablish the links of fraternity and trust with President Uribe, with the understanding that they must help us to free the hostages, using the influence that they have over the people in charge of the FARC, so that they leave the way of terrorism and move towards a way of peace and conciliation.
President Uribe, the president of Colombia. Betancourt and 14 other hostages were rescued in a daring raid by Colombia's special forces, who had infiltrated the highest levels of the FARC, the communist-inspired guerrilla movement, which still holds 700 hostages. Jose de Cordoba, Latin American correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, joins us. And Jose, the three American hostages released are safe in Texas, Ingrid Betancourt with her family in Bogota. But is she right that contacting President Chavez is the next move? He was not successful in his attempts to release the hostages.
Ingrid Betancourt's rescue and that of the other hostages is a huge victory for President Uribe. President Chavez of Venezuela had been trying to use hostage negotiations in order to undercut President Uribe's military effort against the FARC. That appears to be the case from a number of documents that the Colombians found in the computers of Raul Reyes, a FARC leader who was killed in a raid in Ecuador on March the 1st. I think this is an enormous setback for the FARC, but also for Mr. Chavez, who has been pretty much an ally of the FARC.
Well, and so the fact that the Colombia Special Forces, you know, presumably under the direction of President Uribe, could release the hostages where Chavez's negotiations didn't, undercuts, you know, takes some steam perhaps out of his role. But you mentioned FARC. What about FARC itself, established in the 60s, fighting for land reform and trying to reduce the inequity between the rich and the poor in Colombia? We know that they've lost top-level commanders, they've had defections at lower levels, but they still have hostages. So how do you see this playing out?
Well, the FARC has suffered a series of devastating blows in the last few months. But the incredible rescue of Ingrid Betancourt and the other hostages is the biggest blow to the FARC to date, I think. The FARC now must be in total disarray. The fact is, you know, the FARC has gone down from something like 18,000 fighters back in 2002 to around 9,000 to 11,000 now. And this year they've had something like they've had more than 2,000 deserters.
Well, Ingrid Betancourt was running for president against Alvaro Uribe, the current president, when she was taken hostage. He's also now the man whose government rescued her. And standing next to him yesterday, she thanked him, said he'd been a very good president, but that she continues to aspire to serve Colombia as president herself. Is that a serious idea?
No, absolutely. Ingrid Betancourt, you know, I mean, when she was captured in 2002 by the FARC, she was a minor presidential candidate. She had, I think, 1% standing in the polls. But now this makes her, you know, a very important political figure. It's interesting that even when she was in the hands of the FARC, she continued to think and plan about politics. According to former captives who were freed or escaped before yesterday's rescue, Ingrid has worked out a government plan of some 190 points. And, you know, she plans to, for instance, build a new city like Brasilia, which would house the 3 million displaced people displaced in Colombia's violence, and also she had plans to build a high-speed train, you know, from which would unite the north and the south of the country. So she's always thought about politics, when I talked to her mother a couple of months ago for a profile I did of Ingrid, her mother was hoping that she would forget about politics and just relax for a couple of years. But for sure, I think she definitely has a political future.
Jose de Cordoba, Latin American correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Well, all this year, we've been looking at cultural events from 1968 that still resonate today. For instance, who can forget this film moment? That's Strauss, also Sprach Zarathustra, Opus 30, which became one of the most recognizable themes in movie history. And this year, Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey turned 40. Remember the images? Prehistoric apes tentatively touching a black monolith? What the heck was that thing? An ape throws a bone in the air, it turns into an orbiting satellite. Suddenly we're in outer space, where an alien object has been found on the moon. Is it? Yes, there's that monolith again. Enter the Jupiter mission, piloted by astronaut Dave Bowman and his sidekick, the supercomputer HAL. The first chilling and oddly tragic demonstration of what happens when binary thinking merges with the darkest human impulses.
Open the pod bay doors, HAL.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
2001 was based on the writing of Arthur C. Clarke, who died earlier this year. The Brattle Theater here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, recently held a tribute screening. Pierre Dulay, who played astronaut Bowman, took questions and came to our studios where we asked him, what is the question he's asked most?
I think the most common question is, what does it mean? What is the film? what does the end mean? And my stock answer is that Stanley really didn't discuss the esoteric aspects of this film very much with us because, in a way, he wanted us to be as ignorant as the characters. We knew what the nuts and bolts were of our mission, but in terms of what the metaphors were, we didn't discuss that a lot. I mean, my own feelings about it really are based on my just viewing this the movie for the first time.
Well, you know, darn, because here we thought, you know, now it can be told that you would finally reveal why the astronaut Dave Bowman finds himself wandering through space and time and in a sort of a Louis XVI living room at the end of this journey through space. He's all alone. He's an old man. He's an old man who drops a glass. He's eating and suddenly he touches again that monolith and there's a baby in a bubble.
My own take on the ending is that strange room and that aging process is actually all happening inside my head or the head of the character, that the advanced civilization, the alien civilization, whoever they may be, and we never, wisely on Kubrick's part, we never see them, had the ability to go and play a mind like a tape recorder. Maybe that was a room setting I saw when I was passing through the Metropolitan Museum of Art one day, and they just kind of came up with that as a habitat, and that's where I was when the changes which the monolith creates in a number of places in the film, huge change happen when that monolith is present. The apes suddenly discover the first weapon, for example.
The bone.
Yeah. The apes evolve to a human being. Then whatever that, going through time and space, that what I call the light show, that ending up in that strange room, mm-hmm. which I call the cage, quote unquote, then metamorphoses into the next stage, which is what the embryo is. And if you read the book as opposed to seeing the movie, because Kubrick really did not delineate any of this aspect in the film, but in the book, Clarke posited that the two superpowers, the USSR and the United States, would have nuclear weapons in constant orbit around the Earth, and that at a push of a button, that could all rain down on Earth, and that super being, or the next version of Homo sapien, that embryo, would have the power to nullify all that.
Well, let's remind people, because when the film first came out, the U.S. hadn't landed a man on the moon yet. Kennedy had made his challenge to do that, but there was all this excitement and anticipation. And then here comes this script in which Kubrick and Clarke seem to be saying, be careful what you wish for. Mm-hmm. What are you thinking when you're looking through this script, which actually doesn't have a lot of dialogue? What are you thinking?
Interestingly enough, I recognized something when I read the script, and then it suddenly hit me, some within a week or so of reading it, that, yeah, I remember reading that short story written in the something like 48 or 1949 that appeared in some science fiction magazine and then was put into an anthology in the early 50s. And I was a science fiction fan as a kid. It was called The Sentinel. And that dealt with just that one core part of the film where they discover the monolith on the moon.
And this is Arthur C. Clarke's
That's
short
Arthur
story
C.
that
Clarke's
grew
first
into
story.
The into
So
the
that
book.
Hit me when I was reading. I said, my God, I read that story when I was a kid.
But were you also one of those Americans so caught up in that idea of the space race and the subtext to it? I mean, with all the excitement, with the subtext to it of, you know, trying to beat the Soviets and that subtext as well? Or no? Just
I don't think it did for me. The main thing that happened when I got that role was how lucky I was to be working with Stanley Kubrick. That was the big... Right. I was such... When I was going to drama school, I had an afternoon off, and there was a Kirk Douglas movie playing down the street, a war film, and I went down, and it was called Paths of Glory, and I saw it, and from the first frame, it blew me out of my seat. I remember at the end of the film going to the poster and saying, who directed this masterpiece? It was Stanley Kubrick. And so when I was told, out of the blue, I had no idea that I had been proposed for this role, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about your relationship with Hal. Again, you play Dave Bowman, the astronaut. Hal 9000 is the computer that goes down to the dark side. There are also other astronauts and scientists on the spaceship going to see what this monolith is. As the story unfolds, this previously error-free Hal makes a mistake. You and a fellow astronaut discuss pulling Hal's plug. He reads your lips and begins to wreak havoc. He disconnects and kills the cryogenically hibernating crew, cuts off another astronaut while he's outside the ship. Hal locks you outside the ship. This becomes a nightmare. But as you're making it, you know, do you have Hal as an image? I mean, how there's another actor with a voice, but how are you, how's Hal forming in your head?
I'll tell you a story about that. Kubrick didn't know what kind of a voice he wanted, and first he thought, well, I'm going to hire Marty Balsam. Well, he decided he was too New York, so Marty never even started on the film. Then he hired an actor, a British actor by the name of Nigel Davenport, who was very proper and spoke like this, you see. And, no, voice is too English. So he paid him off, but he was gone after the first week or so of shooting, and we were on that film for 4 months, our section of the film. So he just turned to his first assistant director and said, well, you do the voice for the guys. This is the voice of Hal for us for the rest of the film. Dive, take a stress pill. It was all like that. It was like doing it with Michael Caine. Oh, yeah. That was the voice of... So that was acting.
So you had to react to somebody who sounded like Monty Python?
Well, almost, yeah. A bit like this. That's right. So that's why I say it took a lot of acting on our part.
Hal was eventually voiced by Canadian actor Douglas Rain later in post-production. We're going to hear more of Kier DeLay's thoughts on making 2001 A Space Odyssey, including his real sadness at the death of Hal. Later, is your town canceling the fireworks on the 4th? Back in a minute, here and now.
Stop, Dave. I'm afraid. I'm afraid, Dave.
Oh, that's the Hal 9000, the perfect computer gone bad, his brain being taken apart by astronaut Dave Bowman in the film 2001 A Space Odyssey. Though it received mixed reviews when it was first released, Pauline Kael of The New Yorker found 2001 to be a monumentally unimaginative movie. It's now considered a classic and an icon for the science fiction films that followed. Well, we're continuing our conversation with actor Kier DeLay, who played astronaut Bowman. We thought it was so oddly sad when Hal died, and he agreed.
I always refer to the scene where I take his brain apart, because of all the chaos he's created, as my Of Mice and Men scene. It's a little bit like George, whose closest friend is this mentally retarded man, Lenny. Finally, because of certain things that happen in the story of Mice and Men, has to take his life, has to shoot him.
Right.
And he kind of eases his... He has the man look out over the plains and said, you remember, we're going to build a farm, Lenny, and we're going to have the rabbits. Yeah, we're going to have the rabbits, George. And he shoots him. And in a way, when Hal kind of deteriorates and ends up singing Daisy, I mean, R.K., Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer true. When he's singing that song, I kind of have to ease him into it. And that was the most emotional part of my character, because my character really, his emotions were under taps. I mean, we'd, with Kubrick, discussed the fact that they would, in the future, choose astronauts based on their psychological profile, and that what would normally drive someone insane would only kind of affect us a little bit.
Well, in fact, your character and the other human characters seem almost flat and automated.
Absolutely.
Compared to Hal.
Yeah, and that was intentional.
Because what? That idea that you say Kubrick said they choose these unemotional, maybe,
right,
people. But was it also Kubrick's way of saying that in the future humans would be almost stripped of their humanity by technology?
Well, I think that may have been his idea, and the contrast between Hal, as you say, kind of having more personality than we did. But we, subjectively as actors, were doing it because we had these profiles where it would take something like not being let back into the ship to make me, a little emotionally upset.
Yeah.
And forgetting my helmet, which these guys would have been trained never to forget, and I do. That's
yeah.
why I have to go into the emergency hatch.
Yeah.
And taking the brain apart, taking Hal's brain apart.
What was it, by the way, about Hal that got you having to kill him?
Well, I formed a relationship with him during this long voyage. I would show him my artwork. If you remember at the very beginning of the film, I'd show him my artwork. And it was a very... There's a melancholy aspect to the film when you first see these two guys. Kind of they've been together for months and months and months and months, and there's a kind of melancholy and loneliness within the ship because everyone else is asleep.
Well, we're thinking that just a year later, David Bowie comes out with Space Oddity. And that's the feeling that you get of you're just out there drifting, and it's sad.
It is.
It's majestic, but much more, as you said, melancholy.
And when the other astronaut, it's his birthday, and his parents sing him happy birthday, we can't really have a dialogue because there's a time delay. They're so far away from Earth that they can't have a two-way conversation. So he has to just sit there, and his only line is, bring my head up a little bit, Hal, because he's getting suntan, if you remember. And Hal just lifts his head a little bit with the machine.
Mm.
And that's...
Yeah. What was it like to work with Kubrick? Share a story.
It was perfect. He never raised his voice. He created a very safe atmosphere, which my definition of a good director, doesn't matter what their style of directing is, if they create a safe atmosphere, you're going to do good work. He had a droll sense of humor. And I was very... I felt, and again, as I said, I was a Kubrick fan. Mm. The major job he had with me, and he told me this later, was to get me over my awe of him.
How did he do that?
It was,
throw back some beers or something?
He really communicated his belief. For example, he said to me, I can't imagine any other actor doing what you're doing. You were the perfect cat. He made me feel good about myself and why he had chosen me, because I hadn't gone through the process. I hadn't auditioned for him and then won the part. I just got an offer out of the blue. Now, he had screened some films that I had done, like David and Lisa.
I was going to say, had you already done David and Lisa, which is an extraordinary film in which you play a character who doesn't like to be touched, and the young girl you play opposite is a schizophrenic. I mean,
right.
It was an extraordinary film.
Yeah.
So he was probably happy to have you.
Well, yeah, he saw David and Lisa. He saw the first version of The Thin Red Line that I did, and he saw outtakes of a film that I was making when I got the news I was going to do the Kubrick film. I was doing a film with Otto Preminger called Bunny Lake is Missing. Mm. Came home one afternoon. My wife said, call your agent. I called my agent, and he said, are you sitting down? I said, no. He says, you better sit down. I said, what? You've just been offered the lead in Stanley Kubrick's next film. That's how it all happened.
Yeah. Does it still, you're pretty recognizable. You still got those pale blue eyes. Is it one of those things where you're thinking, God, I can't believe all these people are still asking me about 2001? Or does it sort of stay with you as well? Or is it only with you when we make it with you?
It varies. Certainly, if I'm doing anything professionally, the people around me are aware and immediately want to. I just finished a guest spot on a pilot called Castle. And the director I mean, all he wanted whenever he said cut, he just wanted to ask questions about 2001. He wanted his photograph taken with me. Same thing with the producer. Even the still man on the set said, "I've never done this before," but he turned to somebody, "Would you mind taking your photograph so I can stand next to Keir DeLay?" And my reaction is, look, if in a sense all that people remember from my work is 2001, I could do a lot worse. I mean, that would be like being in Citizen Kane and being only recognized from playing a feature or a major role in Citizen Kane. I could do a lot worse.
Yeah. Well, we've been remembering the landmark science fiction film 2001 with Keir DeLay, and it's DeLay, not DeLea.
Right. But I answered it just about anything. Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for coming in today.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
All right, still ahead today, the assisted suicide in Germany of a healthy but lonely older woman. Is that legal? Back after the news, here and now. Germany is having a heated debate over assisted suicide after an elderly but by and large healthy woman killed herself last week with the help of a maverick German politician who's now under investigation for her death. 79-year-old Bettina Schart had some trouble walking around her apartment, but otherwise she was in relatively good health. She lived alone because she never married or had children, and she was afraid of going to a nursing home. So she contacted Roger Kusch, a politician who once advised German chancellors and is an assisted suicide campaigner. Kusch came to Schart's home last Saturday and set up a video camera, which recorded her taking a lethal drug cocktail, saying goodbye, then dying. Kusch came back 3 hours later and then broadcast the result. Joining us from Berlin is Roger Boys, who's been covering the story for the Times of London. Roger, this is Germany, where the Nazis put 100,000 mentally ill and handicapped people to death in World War II. We've got to imagine, well, that this might be sensitive and controversial anywhere. It's especially so in Germany.
Yes, it's a huge taboo here, the whole question of mercy killing. There was a formal systematic program of euthanasia, above all of mentally handicapped people during the war. And so, of course, they're incredibly sensitive about it.
Is there any form of assisted suicide that's legal?
Yes, there is. Of course, this is what this politician is now testing, to see where the limits of the law really are. You can sit with somebody while they're committing suicide, certainly in the preliminary stages, and not really be liable for prosecution. The problem is, of course, if you're actively helping someone to commit suicide, if you're injecting somebody, for example, or if you're pouring poison into their throats, then you are indeed liable to 5 years imprisonment.
Well, walk us through what's known about Roger Kusch's involvement in this case. He is, by the way, a trained lawyer. He was contacted by this woman. Did he provide her the poison? Did he help her in any way?
Well, he claims not. He claims that, because she was a former nurse, you see, the woman who killed herself. She was, at the end of her career, an assistant in a radiological department, and she was a computer literate. So it is plausible that she got these medications herself. The one is a tranquilizer, which is very easy to get, and the other is more complicated and does need a prescription, an anti-malarial drug. So she must have had some kind of help or contacts, but he's denying that he did that.
Well, Roger Kusch is saying that he set up the video camera because he wanted it to be clear that he did not hand any poison to this woman, that he in no way had any hands-on role in her suicide. But why else would she contact him if this is something she could have done by herself?
Well, I think that's the point. I think he set up an association called Sterbehilfe, which means death assistance. And he guided her. And such organizations exist elsewhere, in Switzerland above all, something called Dignitas. And lots of people, especially from Germany, go there to kill themselves. And they're put in protected apartments, and they're shown how to do it. They're given the poisons or whatever are arranged for them, and they kill themselves. Well, what Roger Kusch is trying to do is to do something similar in Germany, but the law doesn't let him go the full way. So what he's been doing, he's had three or four contacts with this woman. And he's basically talked her through it. There are a lot of people who want to kill themselves, and they don't know where to start. Mm-hmm. Well, he knew and knows, and he talked her through it. The reason he got she got in contact with him is that he devised a very macabre machine, really, a very simple machine with potassium chloride. You press a button, and it immediately infuses into your body, and you can kill yourself in this way without implicating anyone else. That's to say, without dragging someone else into illegal actions. And he devised this machine, and he'd got a lot of publicity for it. She'd seen the publicity and thought, aha, here's my man, here's somebody who understands how to commit suicide painlessly and quickly, which is what she wanted. And she made contact with him. And then over three meetings, he talked her through it. Now, but he's claiming right to the end, because he's a little bit nervous about prosecution, that he didn't obtain the medication. That is, of course, what the prosecutor is looking into now, to see whether that's actually credible.
Well, Roger Kusch sounds like the Jack Kevorkian of Germany. And, by the way, we should note that Dignitas says on its website that only the U.S. state of Oregon, the Netherlands, and Belgium permit physician-assisted suicide for residents of those areas. And we're talking about a non-physician-assisted suicide in Germany. What's been some of the reaction? We know the head of the German Medical Association called Roger Kusch an egotistical cynic who's exploited the loneliness of an old lady in his craving for recognition.
Well, yes, I think that's what worries most people who I've seen commenting. Politicians, lawyers, doctors, hospice managers, and so on. These are the people who've been expressing outrage at the moment. And they're worried, because most of the people who go to Dignitas and other organizations like this, they're terminally ill, or they're incurable in some way, or they're worried that their diseases are so degenerative that there'll come a time when they won't be able to kill themselves. That's why it happens. They're multiple sclerosis victims, they've got cancer, they've got all sorts of things. This woman didn't really have anything. She had a bit of back pain.
And
that was it. But she was worried, she was terrified of going into a nursing home. And this, of course, and surveys show that actually a third of old people in Germany are indeed scared of going into a nursing home. It's a legitimate and natural fear of old people. So what people are saying is, well, this is not a good enough reason for helping someone to commit suicide. What he should have been doing is reassuring her that there's nothing to fear about going into a nursing home, rather than playing to her fears. And that's really, this is where it gets very complicated in legal terms, because if he actually spurred those fears and actually encouraged those fears, then he is in violation of the law.
Well, Dr. Jack Kevorkian, who was present when people took their own lives with drugs provided through his lethal injection machine, was jailed. He was released last year. So I suppose what happens now is we wait to see if Roger Kusch will be even charged.
Yes, we'll have to let the law take its course. But, of course, the main worry is that it becomes some kind of precedent, because there are an awful lot of people out there who are depressed and tired of life, and he's attracted a massive amount of publicity now.
Roger Boyce, correspondent for The Times of London. He's based in Berlin, Germany. Roger, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And just a quick note on some of the stories we'll be looking at in the coming days. 40 years ago, singer Johnny Cash went to prison, Folsom Prison, and a reporter went with him with his reel-to-reel recorder. We'll hear the sounds he captured. Also, we're going to take a look at one of the summer's most recommended reads, the story of Edgar Sawtell. Before we go today, your letters, you're listening to Here and Now. Recorded fireworks will have to do for some towns this year. fiscal gloom spoils town's fun is the Boston Globe headline here in Boston, with some fireworks shows canceled because the private donations that fund them just didn't come in. In California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has urged residents not to shoot off fireworks to avoid starting wildfires. North of San Francisco, in Wallela, the show was canceled to protect nesting seabirds. Well, on top of all of this, there is a shortage of fireworks. Julie Heckman is executive director of the Bethesda, Maryland-based American Pyrotechnics Association. Julie, we understand the industry is going to have 15% fewer fireworks this year, and it has to do with an explosion in China that destroyed 20 fireworks warehouses.
There was a significant accident at the warehousing area near a port that exported fireworks. And that particular port, the port of Sanshui, was responsible for moving 70% of the fireworks that we utilize here in the United States.
And I can only imagine that a shortage means that there's a price increase.
Well, China raised the prices of fireworks by 30 to 35% due to their own increased costs for the raw chemicals used to manufacture fireworks, as well as the paper components. So the U.S. importer has paid about 30-35% more, and it's only natural that they're going to pass on some of those costs to their customers and clients.
Right. Well, are there some fireworks in particular that we won't see, even if we have fireworks displays, just because of cost factors and supply factors?
Well, I think with the supply shortage, the good news is no one completely eliminates their stock from year to year. So they're digging deeper into some of their existing stockpiles. The other thing is, with the professional display companies, they've been networking very closely together to fill the gaps that companies may have. Across the board, everybody's missing something, but not necessarily the same thing.
I read a report in the New York Times in May that bottle rockets, ladyfingers, Roman candles, and mortars may be the harder ones to find. I'm trying to remember what a ladyfinger is.
A ladyfinger is a very tiny little firecracker. And backyard fireworks that the general public use to celebrate really have not been significantly impacted. So when people go out to those thousands of retail stands, there's definitely a variety of product to purchase and use this 4th of July.
Well, 4th of July is one thing, but I'm thinking of all the events we have coming up. We have the Olympics. We have big presidential candidate conventions in August and early September, Labor Day. I'm just wondering if maybe, you know, people are also holding on to some fireworks because of the big displays that are still ahead.
Well, that's true, and we're very concerned about the fall holidays moving forward to the Christmas and New Year's Eve season and what impact we could face going into 2009 as a result of some recent transportation restrictions within China related to their Summer Olympics.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure China's holding on to some fireworks as well.
Well, China has two different firework markets. There's fireworks produced for export, and China also has a growing domestic market because they're allowing the general public to purchase and use fireworks, and they don't need the export business as much as they used to.
Huh. Just want to know, are we going to have those little fizzy, they're like little fish that swim around for a little while and then they go out?
Oh, we'll see plenty of fish.
What are they called?
Fish or serpents. It's sometimes difficult to tell the fish swimming versus the serpent.
I love those. That's Julie Heckman, Executive Director of the American Pyrotechnics Association. Julie, thanks so much for speaking to us, and happy 4th, even though it may not be as dazzling as you would like. Happy 4th of July to you.
Thank you. Have a safe holiday.
Well, here in Boston tomorrow night, nearly 500,000 are expected to crowd onto the Charles River Esplanade to watch fireworks burst overhead as millions more watch on television. And Keith Lockhart conducts the Boston Pops and Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. Meanwhile, in a dark, hushed Back Bay basement blocks away, a different kind of orchestration will be underway. Dozens of police officials will crowd in to watch video feeds from cameras along the river. If there's a fight, they'll send officers to break it up. If someone faints, they send an ambulance. It's a long way from the first Pops concert of 1974. Three EMTs on the roof of a building with walkie-talkies. Still to come, Renegade Jennings, back in a minute, here and now. We want to take a few minutes to air some of your thoughts. We really got your attention this week with our report on political mudslinging and rumors. Cheryl McGregor of Phoenix, Arizona, kind of sums it up. She wrote, "Even with a disclaimer before and after, speaking a rumor gives it a life. Ugh." Well, here are a few more recent thoughts. Susan Onion, the librarian at the Acton, Maine Elementary School, loved hearing author Maurice Sendak's explanation of how the loss of his relatives in the Holocaust informed his books. She writes, "The next time I read Where the Wild Things Are, I'll have a very different understanding of the story. I posted the link of the interview to our state library." We also heard in a recent segment about the findings of a new report from the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute. They recommend that the current colorblind adoption laws should be changed so that parents in transracial adoptions can get counseling. Tama Zorn of Brookline, Massachusetts, disagrees. She says it's up to adoptive parents to inform themselves. She writes, "Yes, adoptive parents should be able to ask practical questions like, how do I, a Caucasian, keep the male self-esteem of my black teenage son intact when I have to tell him about the dangers of being stopped driving the family Cadillac while black? But of whom do you all envision asking these questions over the lifetime it takes to raise a kid?" Jenny Hammond of Jenkintown, Pennsylvania, loved the discussion and the report's findings. She writes, "As a Japanese-American adopted by loving Caucasians, I feel that, indeed, I am the first generation of adult transracial adoptees. And during the teenage years, so much time is spent in front of a mirror, looking at a face that doesn't look like your family's. I had no explanation for why my eyebrows were the opposite shape of those in the teen beauty magazine until I went to Japan and realized they came from my Japanese heritage. So I think it's crucial that families who adopt transracially be provided with the resources to educate themselves about what their child and their family will experience." Well, finally, Lorna Atwater of Berea, Kentucky, wrote with a summer music suggestion. She says, "What about the Afropop indie rockers Vampire Weekend, currently number 10 on Billboard's independent album chart?" Lorna writes, "My husband was playing them while delivering the mail, and a college kid said, 'You're listening to Vampire Weekend,' as if only college kids listen to cool music." Send your summer music suggestions and any other thoughts to hear-now.org. Tonight in Eugene, Oregon, runner Gabe Jennings begins his quest to make the U.S. Olympic track team. He's done it before. In 2000, at the age of 21, he convincingly won the 1,500 meters at the U.S. trials and went on to Sydney. But he had a disappointing finish there, and then his life took a strange turn, which included hanging out with Mickey Hart of the Grateful Dead, bicycling from California to Brazil in search of a capoeira dance teacher, rock climbing in British Columbia, and finally back to this week's trials. As an article in this month's issue of Runner's World put it, "Can a loopy, overextended, conga-playing, Goethe-loving rebel athlete attain Olympic glory?" Well, can he? Gabe?
I sure hope so. That's what I've been training for the last decade. The quadrennial has come, and time to perform.
Well, now, what was that trip about? For instance, we understand that you went to Brazil with the goal of learning a Brazilian dance form that you thought could help you in running. I mean, what was going on this trip?
My form was very contracted. Then there was the issues of commercialization of the sport. Then there was the issues of not knowing what to major in.
Well, you were a young man. I mean, you were 21 at this time, and you thought the sport was way too commercial. And you grew up in a household like a lot of parents from the 70s. Yours, you know, sort of rejected a lot of that commercialization and stuff. And you weren't liking it.
I guess that's a good way to put it. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I was, call it depression, call it striving for excellence, but this trip just was my way of projecting myself forward and getting past this obstacle and getting back to that love of running.
Oh, but what a tough trip it was. I mean, you got...
What a tough trip it was indeed.
Well, you got mugged along the way. You caught dysentery. You did, though, pick up drumming from Mickey Hart. What's the drumming doing for you?
Well, I've kind of evolved musically. In fact, I was a music major at Stanford.
Huh.
And the drumming continues to be a pattern in my life, but rhythms, especially in my rutting and my cadence. But the percussion has kind of moved more towards singing, actually. My uncle's giving me voice lessons, operatic voice lessons, and I just built a harp. So the drum lines of 2000 have kind of transferred, I guess you might say, into more harmonious instruments.
Well, you know, it all makes perfect sense to me, but can you see how, you know, here you are in the same crop of runners as Tyson Gay, who's a very, I mean, he's the one who blasted out, set some tailwind-aided records this week. But he's very, you know, straight-laced and straight ahead. And then here you are. What do you think your sort of role in the running world is? Or do you even think about that? Are you just trying to qualify?
Well, first of all, thank you for putting me in the same level as Tyson Gay. And I guess my virtue is my passion, and that's also my challenge. And you could call it a distraction, but I call it just my fire, I guess. And I think it actually focuses me on my running.
Yeah. Well, experts say that Alan Webb, Bernard Lagat, and you could be, you know, the top three racers who will qualify. I mean, you are considered a contender. What's the one thing you feel you need to do?
Well, watching the races go off this past week, you know, there's two sections of the trials, has been an advantage for me. I noticed that a lot of the races were won in the last 100 meters. And, of course, in the 1500, you also have to finish strongly in the last 100. That's kind of an obvious strategic point, but it really grounded home with me that no matter how the race goes, you fall down, it goes out slow or fast, you still have to close that last 100 and hold your form. And when you get tired and that lactate starts hitting your body, it's like a bear on your back. And so it's how much you can conserve early so you have that power at the end. And the other thing to look for is it's not good enough to be top three. You have to be top three with the A standard.
A standard means?
The United States, there's A standard and B standard, and we hold our athletes to the highest standard. You must have the Olympic A standard by the trials final and be top three to make the team.
So you can't just be one of the three best runners.
Right.
You also have to have a certain time.
The critics are saying, a lot of the pundits are saying, the 1500, we have the American record holder, two-time silver medalist, and it's the best field in 30 years. They're going to get the A standard in the final. You don't have to worry about that. However, you still never know. The field might decide to jog the first two laps, in which case guys like me are going to have to get on the horse and really buckle down if we want any chance of making the Olympic team.
Hmm. How much pressure is it, you know, to know that you have this, runners
it's
have one shot?
Enormous pressure. Yeah. I can't even tell you. I get nervous, shivers, just watching some of the other races. It can be a paralyzing pressure, you know, and it's also exhilarating. And it's just the challenge is to channel that into productive energy so you can kind of harness that, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. So will you be dancing the capoeira or drumming or what will you be doing?
Sometimes I do like kind of scat rhythms on the starting line to get me in that capoeira mode of, okay, this is play. Because if you can run like the Zen warrior, the dancer, and kind of play out there, then you're going to be more relaxed and you're going to perform better. So I want to put myself in that mood, and if the capoeira or the drumming or the rhythms, the singing, if that helps get me in that space, then I'm going to utilize that.
Well, Gabe, I really want to let you go because I feel I'm making you nervous.
You are indeed, but that's good.
Talking
about
this.
Nervousness. Thank you, though.
That's 1500-meter runner Gabe Jennings looking to qualify for his second Olympic track team. He'll be the one quoting Goethe and banging on a drum if he makes it to Beijing. Gabe, thanks so much and good luck to you.
Okay, thank you.